Welcome to Living with Dying. I can't believe we're up to 44 episodes and that we've covered so many aspects of death and dying in our attempt to open up the subject and to encourage everyone to talk more about death and dying. It's Baby Loss Awareness Week this week, so I've come to Child Bereavement UK again to talk to Di Stubbs, who's head of training and research here. Di, baby loss is horrendous, isn't it? At whatever stage you lose a baby, whether it's very early or very late, it must be the hardest thing to come to terms with.
It's so true, isn't it, that people can't even envisage it. We imagine both pregnancy and that neonatal period as being a time of just joy and new beginnings. And I think everybody is programmed with hope somewhere along the way. And so I think that makes it a crashingly hard disconnect when something happens, either during the pregnancy or immediately after birth in that first year or something, because the world isn't set up for it. The world's set up for all of the sort of maternity, paternity joy and sharing with families and things like that. And it makes it really a crash, I think. I think it's hard also because there isn't really a hierarchy on these things. Every grief is huge to the person who's experiencing it. But I think with a pregnancy loss, sometimes other people may say the sort of, you can always have another, or some of these things which can make people feel as if there is a hierarchy and they're somewhere towards the bottom. Well, if you have an 11-year-old die, that must be so much worse than if you have a baby die, because you've known them for 11 years. And I've worked with mothers and with fathers with babies die even after a few days, and they go, but they had 11 years. And it's just that you can never really do any of these sort of scales or, as I was saying, hierarchies.
And it's impossible to prepare anyone for a death like that, isn't it? Because you don't go around saying to someone who's telling you they're newly pregnant, I hope it's okay. Yes, you just say, great, fantastic.
if you would, you'd expect them to shake you or something, yes, wouldn't you? Exactly. I think that's very true. And I think nowadays in particular, when we are sort of more familiar with babies living, you know, so maybe my generation, or certainly generations in the 20th century, maybe babies did die more frequently. We haven't seen much of a shift in the rate of babies dying the last few years. It's stayed pretty constant. But all the same, with all of the medical interventions and things, there is still an expectation that you will bring somebody living through. As you say, it's not that much preparation for it. Except I was thinking about some of your previous guests in this wonderful series, such a valuable series that you're doing. The experience of 10 miscarriages is, I think you do then expect the worst every single time. It must be incredibly hard to hope enough to even risk getting through that process another time. And I think anybody who has had repeated miscarriage experience or failed IVF experiences or things like that, I know it is enormous for them because of the extra hope that you're putting in into each time, and will this be the one time? The fact that you don't relax, you're constantly vigilant for your own, your body feels alien to you, you're checking, you're monitoring yourself all of the time, you're not doing rosy glow of early pregnancy or any of those things, you're watchful if you've had that previous experience. And so I think all of that can sometimes make people, certainly those who've had repeated experiences, or whose parents had repeated experiences, or best friend had a bad experience or something, that watchfulness can make the early experience of pregnancy hard.
Harder than a normal pregnancy that you expect to sail through. But should anybody expect to sail through a pregnancy? I'm beginning to wonder if we shouldn't be putting out some warnings somewhere. Maybe doctors should prepare people for not all pregnancies coming to fruition.
I think that's a very interesting point. I think it wasn't until I personally experienced my first miscarriage that I knew the statistics that one in four pregnancies end in loss, you know, which is a huge statistic. But I thought, I actually can't think of anybody else. And then I found that most people I knew had a miscarriage and hadn't talked about it or something, had just learnt that you didn't talk about this. So maybe you're right. Maybe we should, as well as going to antenatal classes, be also having prepare yourself for some challenges along the way. Or at least in the way in which we are increasingly beginning to talk about death and dying and about our thoughts about our own deaths or about those of people around us. Just that whole opening that conversation so that we're a more grief-aware, bereavement-sensitive society will mean that people can talk more about this. And so people find, if there is comfort to be found in other people's experiences, at least a little comfort or a little, as you say, warning about it.
I'm like you. I mean, I had no idea that one in four pregnancies miscarried, and it comes as an awful shock when you find you are miscarrying and nobody's told you that. But I think people, younger people today, we're of a certain generation, aren't we? I think younger people today are more open, aren't they? And they do talk amongst their friends
I
about
think so.
It, don't they?
Yes, indeed.
And that can only be a good thing.
Absolutely. And I think, I'm thinking of a particular family that I worked with, and I don't know if it's true for you, Dillis, but it's certainly true for me, who know perfectly well not only the date of the miscarriages that they've had, but also the due dates of those babies, however long ago. And they always do something special on the due date. They have, even though they have, this particular family I'm thinking on, have gone on to have other children. But they still very much carry that first possibility with them and honour that experience and honour their life, even if it was an extremely brief one and never actually made it into the world. And I don't really want to break it along gender lines along here, but maybe women feel more able to talk about their miscarriages or their attempts at fertility challenges and things. And maybe more men don't talk about it yet and should do, and need encouragement at work and whatever. A few years back when I was working in a team of about seven people, and simultaneously three of the men in the team were going through IVF with their partners or their wives. And I was thinking that was such an unusual experience because they had each other to talk to and buddy, and one of them was an unsuccessful the first time around. And he had, it was to witness him experiencing some of the things that women notice when the other two guys had successful IVF treatment and they were able to have welcome babies into their lives, and he and his wife were going on to their fourth or fifth cycle or whatever it was. And so I don't think you can let it break the feelings down. It's about maybe the expression of feelings, I think.
We're talking mostly about early miscarriage at the moment, aren't we, and early IVF experiences. But I've often wondered how women who have to give birth later on during pregnancy to a child that's died, how on earth they cope.
What a horrendous thing. That it just seems cruel that your body is going to give you pain and agony, and both physical and spiritual and emotional and everything. It just seems so tough, doesn't it? And especially if you've anticipated for a couple of days. It's not, you know now that this is what's going to happen and we will induce you now, but people who've had wait before that is possible, I think is really hard. I think, as you said, these are people who maybe also knew that their baby that they were delivering was going to be life-limited, might not survive the experience. There are also people who aren't actually giving birth to a baby who has already died, but a baby who will die very soon, or within maybe the first year of its life, or the first short period of its life. Again, a complicated sea of emotions to be actually considering.
That's so tough. And presumably you'd recommend people had counselling around that point, wouldn't you?
Absolutely. And there are wonderful organisations, of course, that support families like this. I'm also thinking about families just before we get to that sort of birth point, who either people who seek termination for other reasons, but still can feel the grief years and years later, still know the date of that, still remember the smell of the room, still remember what the doctor was wearing, all of that. Even if that was a freely made choice, it is still a loss of a pregnancy that still can ripple down the years. And there are also the people who seek termination after a sort of a result that's showing that the baby has so many challenges that they're not likely to live, or challenges that will make the child's life exceptionally difficult and make that heartbreaking decision to end the pregnancy at that point. And that it's still a very real person. It's a person who you have been thinking about and planning for and imagining into the future. It's a real rounded story that you are losing. And then if you have the challenges of saying, yes, but I chose to, and you mean, was it really a choice? And you know, all of that language, and what if it's a mother and father, or if it's two mothers or two fathers or whatever, if, you know, that decision, did I really agree with you when you made that decision, or should we have made that decision, but can still, you know, be putting pressure on relationships or pressure on yourself years later?
A terrible scenario to think about. And I'm imagining a lot of people don't find any help, any counselling through these experiences, do they?
There is a tremendous organisation called ARC for people who discover fetal abnormalities that will actually help people through the testing process and the outcomes and offer bereavement support if that's appropriate. But you're right, in some cases, of course, you don't know that until the moment of birth, and then you're in a different sort of, not necessarily a grief, because you have a beautiful child who's been born and you are happy to have, but it's maybe some of the territory that you're going to be travelling through from then on is different to that which you were expecting.
So a lot of longing for dreams and expectations and hopes and things like that.
The wonderful sort of godfather of bereavement studies in the UK, the lovely Colin Murray Parks, uses this expression of the loss of the assumptive world to try and sum up what it is like if, because you have this, you know, your future is different, the future is changed. And I think, I know we're concentrating on pregnancy and maybe that first year of a baby's life, but some parents will have a child die after years of hospital treatment and visits to hospices and hope and recurring illnesses and recurring situations and things like that. So they have been in a world of completely different, a territory of equipment and hospital stays and siblings who have had to do their homework at the ends of beds and things like that.
You look at families like that and you think, how on earth do they get by, don't you?
It's extraordinary. The human spirit is an extraordinary thing. And we can experience so many feelings, even in a moment, between some of the sort of the hopes and the highs and the dreams and things like that, and then some of the tearing sadnesses that come with grief after the loss of anybody important, whatever their age, whatever their size. It's not measurable in days or weeks or minutes or things like that. It's the space they take up in your heart that is what they're measured by and what they're missed by, things like that.
Things have changed over time, haven't they, in the sense that I now understand, and you'll have to help me if I'm right about this, but I understand that if you give birth to a stillborn child, or if the child dies soon after birth and you're in hospital, then you are looked after at least, aren't you?
You really should be, and there is still occasions when this isn't working perfectly, but certainly there is a very good chance, thanks to wonderful staff in the NHS. We, for example, have a project based at the Glasgow and Clyde Children's Hospital, which actually works with families right at that point, doing things like handprints and footprints and, you know, just special things to actually encouraging families to have time with their baby. We have worked with families, thinking of one family in particular, who were able to stay in hospital with, they had twins and one twin died, were able to stay with that baby for quite a while and actually have her with them in a room with the baby who'd lived as well, so that they as a family could actually spend a little time together. And as you say, there are so many things now. Funeral directors are extremely helpful, bereavement midwives, bereavement staff at hospitals or in the community who are able, for example, if you want to take your child home from hospital, that also can be arranged so that they actually can spend one night in their nursery, even after the baby had died.
Sad, isn't it?
Which just make a sort of, it's almost making a physical point of, yes, this is part of your family and it is okay to acknowledge that this experience is very much part of your family and this baby will continue to have a place. And I guess with siblings, that's particularly true because you've got siblings who have been prepared for the birth, have told so many things. You're going to be a wonderful big brother or a wonderful big sister, or I wonder if your baby brother or sister will also love ballet or love football or something. You know, parents will have prepared children with this sort of imagination games around the new baby coming in order to prepare them for the new baby coming. And then when the new baby doesn't come home from hospital or doesn't live, maybe can't even be held if they, yes. It's really difficult, especially if you're too young to understand life and death itself.
So are you saying that it's a useful thing for siblings to actually hold and touch and see the dead child?
I think it can really help. And of course, this is very individual to the child, individual to that sibling. Just because of the way that families work, it's often quite a small gap. So maybe they haven't yet developed a full understanding of what death and dying is. So they are learning new language at the same time. And it's new and confusing language, because we were mentioning stillbirth, for example, which we understand what it means as grown-ups. Really complicated expression for a child. But also the idea that a baby was born dead. It's the two concepts crash into each other in a way. When we're talking to families over the phone, for example, who are in this situation and saying, what on earth do I say, you know, to my older child, or grandparents are saying, my daughter or my son has experienced this, what do we say to the grandchildren? It's very much about needing, even if they don't get the concept because they're still very small, but explaining what death is and adding to that some of the sort of knowledge about what has happened to this particular baby.
So when you say explaining what death is, could you do that for me?
I guess we would be saying, and obviously it's for families to find their own sort of words, but we would be saying something like, all things have their time in life. And then if you can, you would refer to something that they may have known happened. So do you remember your teacher's dog died, or something like that, something to make it maybe a bit more concrete. But then we would be saying, what happens when we die is that our hearts stop beating and our lungs stop breathing, our brain stop thinking, and our body dies. And that means that our body is not able to do any of the things that it used to do. It can't run, it can't drive the car, any of the things that they associate with the person who lived. If it's grandpa, he won't be able to pick you up from football because his body stopped working, etc. And this is what we say is that grandpa has died. And for children, the actual concrete language of death and dying, we often want to shy away from it. We think we can protect them from death and dying by not using the words, by using euphemisms. What we end up doing is thoroughly confusing children, implying that the people are living somewhere else but choosing not to visit or ring or message on phones or anything like this. So the actual language helps a child, even at the younger age, before they've really got a concept of death and dying, at least know that this is a new thing, because it's a new word being used for a new thing. In the same way that if we were talking to children about different shapes for a shape sorter, and they've mastered the square, we wouldn't say this is a different shape, which is we call a three-sided square. We would name it, you know, parents trying to do the right thing by their kids and call it a triangle, because it's a new concept. And it's the same with death and dying. Actually using those words help children begin to build an understanding. That will obviously take them through those primary years to fully understand. Children are really good at fooling us, because they get language long before they get the concept of death and dying. So you'll find a three-year-old cheerfully telling somebody in Sainsbury's, our baby died, but actually understanding what that meant. Granny died, but still believing that granny will pick you up from school on Thursday or something. And I know I've wandered a little bit away from your question, Dilys. So I think I would be saying something like, we've all been planning for and preparing and looking forward to the birth of the baby so much. And we were all really excited. And I know that you've been tremendous and you put your teddy in the room, anything that makes it very much personal. But unfortunately, when the baby was born, the doctors found out that there were some things about the baby's body that just weren't working properly. their heart wasn't beating properly, if possible, giving just a little bit of information. Their lungs weren't breathing properly. It just meant that the baby's body couldn't live. And they tried really hard. And obviously, Daddy and I, Mummy and I, whatever, did everything that we could, both before the baby was born and immediately afterwards. Everybody wanted the baby to live, but the baby's body was not strong enough to live, and the baby died. So something simple like that, and then ideally bring it into something that they know.
And presumably answer every question.
Answer as many questions as you think they've got the understanding for. And also some questions are really difficult to answer. A younger child might ask under those circumstances, will I die too? And the answer is this was something quite different. This was something that affected the baby's body. It's not something that affects yours. You have a lovely, strong body. And there's no reason why you won't live to be 100 and something funny, 110, like The Hobbit, or 123. And say, same with us. We have every intention. But in this case, not. Other questions such as, did the doctors really do everything? Or why couldn't somebody else die instead of our baby? You've also, of course, got the sort of the complication along the way, depending, of course, on the age of the child and their understanding and their preparation for the new baby coming along, to think maybe this wasn't an altogether welcome thing. We like to think it, but maybe they would have preferred a puppy. And so it's really difficult, because children, certainly in the sort of, if they are neurotypical, 5, 6, 7-ish, will make a sort of natural assumption that they're to blame. They've done something wrong somewhere along the way. And so they will need a lot of reassurance that it's nothing anybody did or didn't do or said or didn't say that meant that this happened. It's not that you thought, I wish we were having a puppy, I don't want a baby brother, meant that the baby died. So a lot of reassurance around that as well.
You mentioned the word preparation just there, and it's all the time you've been talking, I've been picturing a nursery with a cot and a baby not coming home. And it suddenly struck me that we don't prepare for other deaths, really, do we? People who die when they're older, you don't make preparations in advance for that exactly. Mm. So having a baby is probably the one thing in life that you've actually got sorted.
Yes.
At least you hope you have, you think you have.
Yes.
You've had to go out and spend money, you've had to equip a nursery, you've had to buy certain things.
Yes.
And then coming home to all of those, not being able to use them.
It's the sort of the things, as you said, those things which take on so much meaning as well, because the things like the cot had this function. You can immediately imagine the baby sleeping in it. Or not sleeping in it, not necessarily the perfect world. You maybe had gone so far as to imagine, oh, maybe we have a baby with colic who doesn't sleep through the night. Mm-hmm. Yes. Or, and we've been mainly talking about those either early pregnancy loss or later pregnancy loss, stillbirth. But of course, neonate babies die in that first year, may have been put down to sleep in that cot and didn't make it through the night or didn't make it through their sleep period. And as you say, some of these objects in a nursery or a corner of a room, wherever the baby is going to be, get so much meaning attached to them. And simultaneously, you want them all cleared out so that there's no reminders. But you also want to hold on to them for the possibility of reminders and the fact that they are a place to put either the imagined baby, if the baby didn't make it home, or the baby who slept in that cot for 6 months and then one day died. Yeah.
Do you find parents do usually, parents who've had a cot death, say, really do want to clear the equipment away, get rid of it?
I think it very much, it's so individual. Sometimes, and that is also difficult if one parent wants to hold on to everything and the other parent really can't bear to hold on to everything. And that's where you sometimes get special areas needing to be created in the house where, for the sake of the person who does need to hold on to the physical items and the physical space, you know, where somebody was. That, of course, can happen to us at any age when we don't want to get rid of the clothes in the wardrobe and things like that, or the tools in the garage. It's part of one of the sort of ways in which we grieve when we go from being extremely sad to actually thinking about getting other things practically done. And then we zigzag between these. And I think that can happen whatever the age of the person who dies. I think it can be also really hard if you've had a child who didn't make it home. So we've been thinking about all of these optimistic things, the cot and the toys and the mobile and the tiny weeny little outfits and things like that. But when people have the sad experience of a baby who maybe spends a few weeks in a special care baby unit or a PICU, but the baby still doesn't make it home. So you have those things sitting, waiting, again, so freighted with hope that maybe because the cot's there, maybe this baby will make it out of the incubator and into the cot because the cot's waiting. So maybe after 3 weeks, 4 weeks, 5 weeks, they will actually make it there, but they don't. Yeah.
It's all so upsetting, isn't it, to think about? Mm-hmm. And I can't imagine how people go through it. One thing I have heard through doing these podcasts is that parents grieve in different ways, don't mm-hmm. they? You mentioned that just now.
Yeah.
That must cause a lot of stress within a family.
And I think we can make some sort of assumptions sometimes. I think even as next door neighbours or friends or something, that if people aren't obviously grieving or something, that maybe they're not feeling it as much as somebody else is. And I know that when we work with couples after the death of a child here at Child Bereavement UK, sometimes you see that sort of accepted pattern where the father is so concerned about the well-being of his partner, the mother of the child, and is always trying to minimise. I think our most common experience would be of a father minimising his own feelings because he genuinely feels, that it is huger for the mum. And experience of the mum going, I brought him here just to make him admit that he's feeling it. I know he's feeling it, but he's not always expressing it the same way.
Can you help in those circumstances?
We help just by being in a place which is there to talk about death and loss and grief and things like that. That sounds a silly thing to say, but sometimes it's the medium is the message or whatever. The fact that you have walked through the door of something which has got child bereavement in its name, you know what you're going for. And so some of the work has happened long before we walk through the door. And we always make a point when we're working with a family or with a child, whatever the circumstances, whoever has died, of actually talking about death right up the front. Hello, my name is of course the worst name under the circumstances, so I'm always Diana rather than Di. Yes. But I'm Diana and I'm pleased to meet you, but I'm sad about the circumstances why you've come here. And that's because naming of a child died, Barney died, you know, Helen died or whatever. So that it's out there immediately. We're not going to go with euphemisms. We will be comfortable talking about whatever you want to talk about. And we find that sometimes, you know, we might do physical activities with families. We might just simply talk. We might talk to both the parents separately. That actually being in a space where talking about this difficult stuff is allowed and encouraged can make an enormous difference. There's some sort of slight myth that couples break up when a child dies. What it seems, and again, I don't think there's been quite enough research into this area yet, what it seems is that the experiences widen the cracks that were possibly already there. It seems as if people, this isn't usually the cause for why couples break up, but it's what puts an awful lot of pressure on an existing fragile structure or somewhere along the way. So if the structure needn't be, can be bolstered by talking and by having the atmosphere that it's okay to talk about these things, I think that maybe that they can find their ways through to support each other, to support their children, and of course support other wider members of the family. Grandparents have to see their own children experience such grief, as well as losing their grandchild, and seeing in some circumstances their other grandchildren, their siblings, bereaved as well, and very much put their own feelings onto the back burner in order to try and extend their love and support out and wider to people.
So what is the best thing we can do? Can we wrap up by you giving us some advice on how the rest of us, how the wider community can support people who've lost a baby at any stage, as we've just been discussing, without saying things like, oh, you can try again, what good things can we say and do to be supportive?
Absolutely. And it is really important that we do say this. SANS, that wonderful organisation for anybody in this situation, Stillbirth Neonatal Death Society, SANS did a survey a little while back and found that people returning to work after a pregnancy loss, 43%, nobody mentioned it at all. Just most of them said people didn't know what to say, or nobody, I wasn't offered any support. Nearly half of people had the experience that nobody mentioned what happened. In terms of what actually helps the most is parents, children, everybody says is acknowledging, is actually saying, I was really sorry to hear what happened. And ideally, if you can add to that, not only the language, but also the name can be really powerful. I was really sorry to hear that your baby, Ben, died. And something else, that must be so tough. People say there's always a bit of a sort of challenge around, do we use platitudes and things like this? I'm so sorry, or I was so sorry to hear that. Most bereaved people that we talk to say, do you know, I didn't actually hear the words. I didn't actually pay much attention to what they said. I just noticed that they bothered to say something. And I think that's the thing. It's having the courage to do it. This is a sidetrack, Dilys, if you'd forgive me. But one of the stories that still sometimes chokes me up is a child that I worked with whose mum had died. And we were talking actually a couple of years or so afterwards. And she was saying that the single best thing that happened to her up until the point that she'd started coming to get some bereavement support was that she was stopped in the school corridor by the chemistry teacher. And the chemistry teacher said, the girl's name, I was so sorry to hear that your mother had died. That must be really tough for you. You know where my room is. If you ever want just some time out, or if you want to talk to somebody, you know where it is.
Oh, that's brilliant.
And she said, I didn't even do chemistry. I didn't know he knew who I was. She said, she said to me, I never went. But when I think about it now, she said, it probably took him 8 seconds. And it was... it makes me choke up. Because he bothered to do it, he bothered to confront his fears of, oh, what if they cry on me? Yes. Oh, what if I don't know what to do when they say the next sentence or anything like that? He just comfortably confronted what had happened, and it made all of the difference. So I think that's what we, when we hear about anybody, whatever stage along the journey that they lose this most precious being, it's about acknowledging that, first of all. And then I guess it's about asking, what's the most helpful thing? Do you want me to tell all of the office? Would you like to tell them yourself? Come to me if you need time off. People who've been bereaved always say that one of the worst things, even though it comes from a place of kindness, is people saying, just call me, anything, just anything. Whereas in fact, the most helpful thing is, I'm standing in Sainsbury's, even if you're not, can I pick you anything up? And then you'll say, yes, I've only got half a load of washing and it's a bit of a waste. Can I come and pick yours up? I'm just going to take my kids to the park. Can I pick up Fred on the way?
So something positive, something, a plan of action.
Something that the person can say an easy yes to rather than have to think. Having the community support as well, as you said, and that might be the child, siblings, school, being aware of what's happened and making sure that other people at transition points no important dates and things like that. It's about your faith community or your cultural community or the way in which your family operates. Make space for the little person who didn't make it. So it's not just writing them out of history. It's still making them an important part of this family that keeps on going.
One of the lessons I've learned is that people who are bereaved really want to talk about the person they've lost, and they don't get enough time and space to do that. Now, when it's a tiny baby who's hardly had a life, I suppose that could be different, but there's no reason why it should be. I'm sure parents would still like to talk about this baby, about their hopes and dreams for it.
The families tell us that they are fortunate enough to give birth to a live baby who keeps on living. Everybody wants to hear the birth story. But if the baby doesn't make it, nobody wants to hear the birth story. And so you also have a story which is really significant to your life that's still held up and stuck inside you. And I think sometimes it's some of these awful jarrings. We have a wonderful supporter from an organisation in Scotland who sometimes talks for us on groups when we're talking about men and grief, or men and boys and grief. And he and his wife had this experience of their precious baby not making it after about 3 weeks, so never made it out of hospital. They had hope every day. Eventually they were able to have a very quick cuddle, all of these huge milestones that normally, as you say, you would talk about a lot. So their eyes opened and all of this stuff. But then the baby died, and the death needed to be registered, but the birth hadn't been registered. And so the person that I'm describing was thoughtful enough to ring up the registry office and say, we're coming in, and this is going to be difficult. It's going to be a complicated thing because we need to register our baby's birth and our baby's death. And the person on the end of the phone was perfect, said, understand. But the message didn't get passed through.
Oh.
So they were greeted with a congratulations pack and an overexcited registrar and things. Yes.
Oh.
Congratulations, what's the baby's name? And then, yes. So I think the most helpful thing we can do is to just be, have our antennae out and to be tuned and to acknowledge that if they're friends or if we're close enough, put the important dates into our calendar so that we know when the due date was. And we know when the due date was 10 years down the line, so that we can still know that they will be counting it and noticing it and wanting it remembered.
And mention the baby's name again.
And mention the baby's name. And as you said, any memory, if you've got them, if there is a memory, yes. I remember how much they loved the little giraffe. I remember your mum made that lovely yellow cardigan, and I remember how cute they looked in it. Tiny things mean a lot if they're all the memories you have.
Di, thank you so much for talking to me. That's been fascinating. Death is never easy, but there are ways we can help each other through it. And if you've found any of these episodes helpful, please think about liking and sharing. And if you can help spread the word by telling just one other person, thank you. And a huge thanks to Joe Barrett, without whom these podcasts would simply not be possible. You can contact us on hello@livingwithdying.co.uk.